good evening, evening, morning. My name is Lee Richmond. I'm a guest speaker. Let me ask again, since people came in late, is there anyone who's new today? All old timers. How many people were here 2 weeks ago when I spoke? About 2/3, okay. So I don't have to do a lot of review. Who was here last week? Who was the speaker last week? Mm-hmm. Sylvia was here. What did she talk about? Do you remember? Ah. Yeah, we have this little game. What did I talk about? Last time I was here, I talked about Vimalakirti and the householder and practice in the world. And today I want to continue that. But let me ask, since I come from the Zen tradition, I'm Lou Richmond, incidentally, for those of you who weren't here 2 weeks ago, and I come from the Zen tradition, and I know many of you have some experience in meditation practice going on retreat. How would you describe the meditation practice you do when you come to retreat or when you sit on your own? Can anybody just briefly say, so I have some sense of context? Being present, so you have no specific object of mindfulness, like breathing or anything. The breath. Everybody uses the breath. Mindfulness of breathing, that's the... Okay. How many people have been practicing Dharma for more than 5 years? Less than 1 year? 1 to 5 years? We're mostly 1 to 5 years here. How do you like it? Yeah, I put you on the spot, I'm sorry. Yes, there's a courageous soul. That's good, thank you. Anyone else? Well, we're all Americans, and we come out of a... Were any of you born Buddhists? My son was, but we're all too old. We're converts, so we come out of a different mode, a different psyche, really. And I think in general, in religious life around the world, over time, there are basically two approaches. to be saved or to be awake. These are the two basic approaches. And emotionally, all of us want to be saved. But some of us may also want to be awake. And some of us may feel that they're the same thing. But emotionally, we want to be saved. And I'm speaking in a kind of Christian sense, to surrender to something that will take care of us. I'm sorry? No, you save us, that's right. It's very lonely to be a human being. Easier maybe to be a turkey. That's why I was hopeful I would hear them. I like hearing them. I did hear some nice birds. And I like the heater here. You know, the heater is like a sentient being, and it comes up. It's what? It talks, yeah. It comes up and it goes, and then it stops. And you feel this spacious, you know, it's more spacious. And it comes. It feels like some kind of person, you know, wanting to get out, like us. And maybe trying to communicate, trying to call out, wanting to be saved. Those of you who've done long retreats know that you get into the deeper territory of consciousness and various things come up like that. Things that are hard to explain, hard to articulate. Well, I should add another category. People that hasn't occurred to them either to be saved or to be awake. They're just kind of, you know, their blower is off or something. It's just not going yet. Well, as you know, the word Buddha means awake or awaken, and we come down on the side of being awake. And Buddhism as an institution, as a history, as a body of teaching is very big. Multitudes of traditions, multitudes of languages, and so on. But essentially, it's very simple, really. To be awake is to be awake, and the essence of being awake is to look. Look. What's hard about this is it's very hard to look and it's very hard to keep looking. So we need lots of structure or else we'll give up. It's too subtle. There are CDs now, so this analogy doesn't work, but I see all of you are old enough to remember the needle and the elves and the records. And they're coming back now as a kind of nostalgia item. But you know, when you put the needle on the record, but the speakers aren't on, like the switch, it's a very tiny sound. You barely hear it. If you put on Beethoven's Fifth and you don't have the speaker, and you listen very closely, you can hear a little scratchy. You just barely hear it. If you turn the speaker on and suddenly it's bum, 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 you know, it's very big and you feel, now I'm listening to Beethoven's Fifth. This is the music. So that's a metaphor for what I mean. We say look at the mind, but the mind isn't quite right. Or the breath, but the breath isn't quite right either. Even that is some kind of amplification. But most of us have a very hard time listening to the sound without an elaborate speaker system. So this is Buddhism, speaker system, to give you the sense that there's something, some edifice that you can approach. So it's a little bit like being saved. You can feel the temple door, you can come in, there's a statue. You know, in the first four centuries of Buddhism, there were no statues. Did you all know this? No statues. And the first statues were about 100 BC in the modern day Afghanistan, which at that time was a Greek colony. And the Greeks had their statues of their gods, and the Buddhists got the idea of doing statues from them, really. And the first Buddhist statues had very Western Apollo-like faces. The statues you see in museums with Asian faces are from later, when Buddhism came to Asia. But the earliest statues are stone, and they have Western faces, mustaches sometimes. Very beautiful. So in the beginning, there was just the Dharma, the words of the Buddha, and people tried their best to follow them. But over time, the thing about Buddhism, it's a little like the internet. There's over a billion websites now. Google is very proud, they say on their homepage, over 1 billion websites searched. Well, Buddhism is a little like each person's lifetime, each person who contributes to the teaching is like putting a website onto Buddhism. And there's no one out there purging the website, so pretty soon there's many, many websites of teaching. And it may seem very overwhelming or complicated, but if you look at a lot of the websites, that is, study the teachings and study the commentaries, you find that people keep saying the same basic things over and over in different ways. Different kinds of approaches for different sorts of people. Some approaches are more for emotional type people. Some are very cerebral for people that approach things intellectually. And so on. Some are very visual. Some are very devotional. And some are very imaginative. But there is an astonishing congruence in all this teaching. If you look underneath to a few very basic things, even meditation is not the most basic thing. You may think that Buddhism is about meditation. But even that is not the most basic thing. The most basic thing is to look, a sense of radical inquiry. And looking is more fundamental than sitting in silence in some place, Spirit Rock. This is a kind of looking. It's a kind of looking which minimizes distraction. But the main thing is to look, to inquire. Inquire about what? Probably just the word what is the most, if you have to say anything, is the most basic form of inquiry. What about it? What about being here at all? And it grows from there. There are only a few really basic inquiries, and really just one inquiry. Another way to say it, the Buddha said, is to inquire about the thing called we call self, the I, the me. Another form of inquiry, really the inquiry that began the Buddha in his quest to be awake, was suffering. He saw things. There is, I think you must know, in the story of the Buddha's life, there's something called the four sightings, or the four seeings. He saw a sick person, an old person, a dead person and a monk, a sadhu. And that began his inquiry. The legend has it that he lived in a palace. It's like a fairy tale. And his father, the king, wouldn't let him see any of these things. There were never any old people around him, never any sick people. This is a very important part of the story. This represents who we are before we open the door and look. So this is a very basic psychological state, like being a child. You just accept things. And we live in a kind of palace. The palace of the Buddha is like when we're a child. You don't really question things. You just grow up and your parents are there. And the world is the way it is. It's not until something occurs to us, perhaps a crisis. I'm sure if I asked you, each one of you would have a story about what brought you here. And at that point, inquiry begins. And if you think about it, the inquiry of the sick person, the old person, the dead person, is really an inquiry about self. And not just an inquiry about self, but how all the cells in the world interact and live with each other and treat each other, and why things are the way they are. There are a number of inquiries that come out of this. But the basic inquiry is to have this question in mind. There are a number of ways to go about it. And incidentally, that moment in time is the moment where we feel that the need to be saved. We're opened up to something that's very hard to bear, and we want some help. So, in our culture, getting saved is, in many parts of the country, a really important thing. A friend of mine who was a Buddhist for many years moved back to Georgia, rural Georgia. She lived on a farm. And she had a daughter. And they were having a picnic with their neighbors. And the daughter ran over to her. She was playing with her friends. She was about five. She ran over to my friend, the Buddhist, and said, "Mommy, am I saved?" Now, she had to think quickly because she has to live in this place. And she'd not told any of her friends there that she was a Buddhist, whatever that was. So she said to her daughter, "Yes, you're saved." So the daughter ran back. She was very happy. The Buddha actually looked at that, studied with all the philosophical and spiritual teachers of the time, just as we are doing. There's all this ferment in America now and in the West. We have these different traditions and we're asking the question. And his conclusion was, yes, you can be saved, but he wasn't sure that the fundamental question that he had was really answered. So he kept going. There are a number of different ways to look, and I don't think you'll find this list in any Buddhist teaching. I've compiled it really from my own experience and my own knowledge of the teachings, but I think you'll agree that these are the basic ones. The most fundamental inquiry is inquiry of yourself. And this is why we sit for an hour, for a day, for a week, for a month, because in that environment, there's not much going on except our own being, our own breathing, our own living. So you can actually look at that in a way that's very hard in ordinary life. So inquiry, self-inquiry, is the most fundamental. But it's not the only one. And if we think that's the only kind of inquiry that will help us, that's rather limiting. And it creates the issue that you feel, I'm really doing my spiritual work in retreat, but the rest of my life is a between time, waiting for, not for Godot, but for the next retreat. Godot, the play Godot, is about being saved, waiting for that thing to come to. Everything will be okay if just Godot comes. So living from retreat to retreat, or living only within self-inquiry, is not enough to be a Buddha. Maybe enough to begin, but to be completely awake, we need more. The second kind of inquiry is, you might say, with a friend, with a spiritual friend, someone who is with you in your practice, but has no special relationship, just a friend, somebody you can trust, and you can talk about things. So after a retreat, for example, with your friend, you can compare notes. How was it? What happened? How was it for you? Another kind of inquiry is what we're doing here. Well, right now, you're listening to me, so I'm playing the role of teacher. So inquiry of a teacher is always been very important in Buddhism. It's why it's a transmitted teaching, not simply something that you read. It's very helpful to inquire of someone who's had more experience than you have of doing inquiry, so you can learn. So there's an apprenticeship quality to inquiry. Another kind of inquiry, which I'd like to see us do more in America, is group inquiry. In the early days of Zen, probably some of you have read various books about Zen. It's not unusual for people in the Buddhist scene to read various things. And you read about these dialogues, Zen dialogues of various kinds. Well, in the earliest days of Zen, the preponderance of those dialogues happened in public. There was a quality that the whole community was dedicated to inquiry, and everybody had pretty much the same few questions. So it was very useful to trust the community enough to simply open yourself up and inquire in public so that everyone could have the benefit of the inquiry. So it was a very Quaker-like, radical sort of environment. I think for two reasons, or a number of reasons, two main reasons, I think that over time did not continue. One is that those societies are very hierarchical societies, and not egalitarian societies. So there was a sense that real inquiry was with the master, one-on-one. That's where it all happened. And secondly, the terrain of spiritual inquiry and the terrain of personal difficulty have a lot of overlap. So many things are quite private that come up in your inquiry, and it's not something you want to expose to a whole group of people, and that's natural. So there needs to be a protected space for that to happen. But nevertheless, I think there's a role for group inquiry that's different than just conversation or chatting, but has a more, there's really a sense that we're inquiring of each other. And the last inquiry, which is really the topic of my talk, although my talk's almost over, but sometimes I put the topic at the end, so you know what the topic was, is inquiry of the world. This is the inquiry that, in a sense, retreat practice meditation practice prepares you, gives you the tools, gives you, you might say, the yogic power to maintain inquiry in life itself. It's always been very interesting to me, because I'm well-schooled in the Zen literature, which is a lot, the stuff they wrote down had a lot to do with the moment in inquiry where people break through or have an insight. It almost never happens in meditation. It's often in conversation, casual conversation during work. Sometimes it's while they're walking down the road. Sometimes it's something like hearing turkeys. There's one about seeing apricot blossoms. So the world itself can be our teacher and can be the place where inquiry comes to fruition. So I've mentioned five different kinds of inquiry. They're all the same, and yet they have different flavors. And last week I talked about the practice of the householder, the fact that we're all householders. Very few of us are going to be professional monks. Even I am not a professional monk in that sense. I have a wife and child and a business. The Dalai Lama was asked, this has been on the web, is it necessary to live many years in retreat, or is it possible to practice seriously in the world? And his response might surprise you. He said, well, maybe a week or a month out of your year, if you can do it, it would be good to retreat from the world and concentrate. But for the most part, you live in the world, you try to be a sincere human being. Maybe for some few people, the vocation of a lifetime monk is appropriate. He said maybe one or two in a million. So he's very much coming down on the side, and maybe this is his skillful means for the modern age, but I don't think entirely so. I think he's just saying what he thinks, that actually the notion, and he's a monk, of course, so he's speaking from that place, that actually the archetype or the vision or dream of being a monk as the way out is a little bit like being saved. You know, we don't bring Jesus into our life, but we have other things that are comparable. We say, well, I'm going to quit my job, go on retreat, really be serious, as though somehow that will make you be serious. Being serious is something that you can easily fool yourself about. The time when we all get serious is when we're sick or when we're dying. That's why the things that the Buddha saw that made him start his search were a sick person and an old person, a sick person, a dying person. So we're all getting on, I can see. And we're probably all thinking, I wonder what it's all about. And we're old enough to have some experience. And really, the moment that you came here and started practicing Buddhism is not the moment of inquiry. The moment of inquiry actually begins when you're born, and it's been going on all the time. So there's not a special thing called Buddhism that you step over the threshold and suddenly you're a Buddhist and suddenly you're doing something different than what you've always done. There isn't actually anything called Buddhism, really. There is life itself, there is you yourself, and there is something nameless and formless that's very hard. I'm trying to give some form to it in my talk, that in the Mahayana tradition we call Buddha nature, but this is just a word. It makes it sound like it's something, it makes it sound like it's a soul, or it's the place where you're really all right. It's better not to give it a name, but it's the place from which our inquiry comes, and it's the place toward which our inquiry is directed. So the practice of the householder, well, let me just talk about monks and householders a little more. It's not that one is better than the other. They each have their strong and weak points. Now, I'm defining monk as you when you're on retreat and you're a temporary monk, just like you're a temporary human being as long as you're alive. The advantage of being a monk is that there's not much distraction, so you can really focus your inquiry. But there's some disadvantage in being a monk because not much happens to you. So you have the illusion you're very much in control of your inquiry. The advantage of the householder is that, well, the disadvantage of the householder, obviously, is you're not very concentrated. It's very distracting to be out there. But the advantage is things happen to you, a lot of things. And that happening quality is a tremendous help in the inquiry, because if you're totally in control of the inquiry, you only tend to inquire about things that are on your radar screen. But if something pops up, like for the Buddha, it was the old person or the dying person, something shocking, something that's not on your radar, that's not within your experience, that becomes your teacher. So the householder's life is full of opportunity. Lots of opportunity, very little concentration. The monk's life, lots of concentration, not so much opportunity. So if you read stories of Buddhist monastic life, a lot of the teaching devices, a lot of the things that happen are, in a sense, compensations for the fact that they don't have a lot of things happening to them. It's a very structured, well-ordered, incubated life. So the teacher has to create situations that shake you up. You can't be too comfortable in your inquiry, or then it ceases to be inquiry, and then you're just getting saved, which is okay. It may sound like I'm putting down getting saved. Actually, getting saved and inquiry are not different. You agree? Good. He agrees with me anyway. He and the turkeys are on my side. Oh, good. In human form, temporarily. Actually, that was Buddha's question. How can I be saved as a human being? But the approach he took, and we might actually, we can only speculate, no one really knows at this stage after so long what Jesus was really like or who he really was. There are, unlike in Buddhism, where there hasn't been much purging in the websites, remember that analogy, there's been a lot of purging in the Christian website. They took a lot of scriptures and burned them, along with the people who wrote them. And there was a lot of, you know, just like after Buddha died, after Jesus died, there were many different schools of teaching about who he was and what his teaching was. And there were many schools, as expressed in the Gnostic Gospels and other texts, in which he was not the Son of God. He was a great spiritual teacher, a great guide, a great rabbi, and was treated that way in that tradition. Well, the Buddhist sects disagreed a lot too, and there's a lot of propaganda in the Buddhist scriptures, but for the most part, they didn't burn each other at the stake. Whereas we can't say the same about our own tradition, but as we know from today, religious war is the worst kind of war. It's better to fight a war over money or land than religion, because money or land you can negotiate about when it comes down to it. But when it comes to God, no one's willing to negotiate. It's too basic. So the most horrible things happen when people fight over, you know, if we dispute the land because we were here first, that's a very human thing. I was here first. You can hear kids talking that way all the time. I was here first. It's not fair. This is in the human realm. But if you say, God gave me this land, and if you step over the line, I will kill you, that's a lot more serious. Kids don't do that so much. You need to be an adult with a religious fanaticism to do that. Pardon the digression. But I'm talking about getting saved. We have out here in Marin County, a very tolerant ethos about our spirituality, and we accept the fact that there are many paths. But I'm convinced, speaking as someone who spent a year in Christian seminary when I was very young, inquiry is at the root of it all. The inquiring mind, which I just realized is the title of your magazine. Inquiry could be a translation of the word vipassana. The other term, you know, samatha and vipassana. Samatha means concentration. Vipassana means, often translated as insight, but practically speaking, it means inquiry. You need both. These are two halves of the same process. And we shouldn't, the main point of my talk, and then I'm going to stop and open it up, is we shouldn't imagine that samatha is a prerequisite for vipassana. It's prerequisite is not quite right. Let's say, put it this way, inquiry can happen whether or not samatha is there, but samatha, some experience of samatha, which I would say is yogic development, you may not call it that, but it really is very helpful as a kind of lens to focus. If our inquiry is very blurry and our focus isn't good, like someone who can't see very well, it's hard to see anything clearly. So samatha is a kind of focusing device to help our inquiry become precise. But every moment is an opportunity for inquiry, and there isn't a hierarchy of moments where retreat moments are better and kitchen moments aren't as good and diaper changing moments are the worst. They're all the same. Whether or not they're good or bad is beside the point. The real point is your inquiry circuit turned on or not? And what does tend to happen as you develop the yogic power of samatha on retreat is that the inquiry circuit tends to be on more and more. So you have more and more opportunities that you can see. The average person walks by 10,000 opportunities a day, doesn't see any of them. Maybe for us, we're a little bit better. We might see 5 or 6. But 5 or 6 is good. You can see 5 or 6. And it's not like we get saved in the sense that everything's okay after that. The inquiry goes on forever. Even the Buddha is inquiring. Even the greatest Buddhist master is inquiring. Even the Dalai Lama is inquiring. The inquiry is not in the interest of a goal, it's in the interest of itself. So this is what it means to be awake. If we think that we can't be awake like the Buddha until something enormous happens to us, that's selling ourselves short. I was reading an informal text by Dogen, who was the founder of Soto sect in Japan, of Zen. And he's in the meditation hall and about to let his head monk give his first talk. And he says, "Head monk, don't underestimate your abilities. Give us a talk about," and he gave some topic. I thought that phrase, "don't underestimate your abilities," is a very beautiful thing. I thought that, you know, sometimes when you, this is a kind of inquiry thing. When you develop the yogic power to look, things start to speak to you. You know, and then when you study Buddhism, it isn't just reading things. Certain things come out and they reach out to you. And this was, for me, a phrase that reached out. I was very encouraged over several centuries to have him say, "Don't underestimate your abilities." I think this is a great message for all of us here. Not to think, oh well, we're schleppy Americans, we can't possibly understand Buddhism, we do the best we can, but somewhere off in space or time, there are some really great people and they really understand. Back in the 60s, when everything was, you know, there was this notion that somewhere in the Himalayas there were nine great masters that held up the world. And somehow they were the ones that were really doing it. And we were all very grateful that they were there. This is like getting saved. Someone out there is going to do it for us. Buddhism is difficult only because it puts the responsibility but also the opportunity on ourselves. And basically the message is don't underestimate your ability. So with that, I will stop talking for a moment and see if any of you have something to say. Yes? See, you're in the story. You saw a sick person. This is why the story is so important. What do you think the Buddha felt when he saw that Prince Siddhartha, little teenage Prince Siddhartha, 29 years old? I don't know what to do. Help. The sick person happened to be you, unfortunately, but... Someone else? I don't think so. Everybody worries. It's a human nature. because it's frightening to be here, and all sorts of things threaten us and frighten us. Worry is very interesting, actually. I'm glad you brought that up. Worry is actually a kind of samatha. It's a kind of meditation. But it's what technically in Buddhism is called, I forget the exact word, wrong concentration. It's concentration in the sense that you essentially worry is repetitive thinking. My daughter's late coming home from the date. My daughter's late coming home from the date. What's going to happen? Maybe she's been in a car crash. Maybe she's dead. Maybe she's been kidnapped. What am I going to do? I'm so angry with her. I should never let her go out with that schlep. You know, this is worry. Worry is a very concentrated form of thinking, but it's corrosive. Following the breath is not that different, except that it's not corrosive. So they're closely related. They both draw on the potential of the mind to concentrate on a thought or a sensation. Worry is partly physical, and there's a sensation quality to worry. Yes, I would say that's true. And I think it's also true what you said, that worry can turn into a kind of inquiry. It's a subtle shift. Anything that's worry can become inquiry very quickly. Just take the example I brought up. I don't have a daughter, but I'm sure some of you do. I have a son. But so you're worried about this. You could say, as the Buddha said about everything, what is the cause? What is the reason? Why am I having this worry? And then you can go down the road of vipassana, and suddenly that worry can turn into something that can bring you insight. So I wouldn't necessarily think of worry as a bad thing or a sign that we're spiritually immature or any of those things. It's just one of those things that tends to happen a lot more in household life. So it qualifies as great opportunity, but you have very little time or concentration to deal with it. But it's not, if you've ever been in a long retreat, worry is right there with you. In fact, I know some people who spend their whole retreat just living inside their worry, and that becomes their inquiry. So, interesting point, isn't it? But technically speaking, worry is a concentrated state of mind, actually. People who are distracted and confused or drugged or drunk don't worry. That's why they're in that state, to avoid it. So it's painful. You don't want the pain, so you do a variety of things, including pray, which helps the worry because you're substituting one concentrated state for another that's less corrosive. But from the standpoint of being awake, we welcome worry as an opportunity. Yes? I did say that. Well, maybe I should qualify and say permanent goal. If you think of inquiry as a means to get to a certain state where you won't need to do it anymore, that's what I mean. Let's suppose you're completely and utterly happy and you remain that way for the rest of your life. What about everybody else, you see? And so then that's good for you, but I'm in great pain, and you know me, and you love me. So, do you care about me? Then your inquiry expands. This is, you can see this development in Buddhism, that very much the inquiry was inward, because that was the Buddha's approach. But over time, they began to realize the inquiry has to keep expanding. And this is where we have ideas like the Bodhisattva vow and liberating all beings. I'm sure the Dalai Lama, with his great training and meditative skill, and you actually can see him, he's quite happy in a certain way. But also think of the burden he carries. I read today in the paper that he's trying once again to have some conversation with the Chinese government after his whole life, since 59, trying. He has the whole suffering of his people on his shoulders, and they look to him. So, yes, he's happy in a certain sense, but how happy can he really be? That's, I think, what I meant. So his inquiry, what's the best way for me to be the Dalai Lama in this situation? In the early days, he stayed at Green Gulch when I was living there down the road. This was before he was a superstar. And he had some, State Department wouldn't protect him because of some politics. So, and they were quite nervous that he'd be assassinated traveling around. So he had big Tibetans with him, unarmed. They were rather formidable. But he was being interviewed by CBS there, one of the first big interviews. And the guy had some set of questions he'd been told to ask. So he said, well, I understand that you're considered the incarnation of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva by the Tibetans. What about that? That essentially he was a god. And in the paper today, they refer to him as the God King. And you might expect him to be self-deprecatory and say, oh, well, don't. Instead, he got very serious and he said, well, it's a great responsibility. I thought that was a... He didn't spend much time talking about whether that were, quote, true or not. He just said what is true is that it's a great responsibility. So, regardless of our situation, inquiry continues. That's all I meant. But it doesn't... Of course, if we don't have any goal, our inquiry stops. So it's good that you have a goal. Nothing is... If you look long enough in Buddhism, you'll find the opposite of everything that it says. Yes, in the back. Well, there are many practices. The word practice in the singular is our singular misappropriation of the word in America. I think it comes from us folks in Zen, because in Zen they have this word shugyo, which is translated as practice. Really isn't the right word. My wife doesn't like it at all, because people use it to justify all sorts of odd behavior. I don't know of a better word offhand. Inquiry is pretty good. I would say inquiry is what it is, and concentration is what it is. And together they can help you. Let's just leave it at that. But when you say to somebody, what is your practice, that comes out of a tradition where the standard answer when you're inquiring, when you're going to meet a teacher, is what is your sadhana? That's the Sanskrit for practice, and who is your guru? So you can say, well, my sadhana is to do meditation 16 and the 32 meditations of Vajrasattva, or something like that. So it becomes a kind of specialty within... When I'm speaking about inquiry, I'm speaking about something very broad. It underlies all the specific practices. All the specific practices are specific ways or methods or varieties of inquiry. If that makes sense. Yes? a very, very human experience. And I've had those experiences. I think most of us have. So, it was an opportunity. And what you're talking about is something you weren't sure you could handle. Maybe you didn't feel at the time you could handle. But you did handle it. I was very ill some years ago, and my brain was damaged. And I felt like you, all my practice went out the window. But it really didn't. There's different situations in which we find ourselves. Sometimes we're in a very calm retreat and it's very wonderful. Sometimes we're on a plane that's maybe going down or something. Or the car's coming head on. I'll just finish my thought. So it will take you deeper. Those experiences will just take you deeper. And the sense that you had that you couldn't handle it is okay. Don't be so sure that's the truth either. Wouldn't worry too much about whether you handled it or not. It happened. And my sense is, to speak in a more technical way, that even in the midst of those terrifying moments, the power of your practice was there. And the way that you talked about it indicates, and I'm listening closely, that it was there. So nothing to feel bad about. In fact, this is what I was talking about. Monks don't fly in planes that are going down that frequently. So they can go for years thinking that they're hot stuff until they get on the plane. You're just a regular person trying to be a monk 10 minutes a day, but already you've had that plane experience. You're way ahead of the game. You see, that's what I mean. It's not, we shouldn't have assumptions about what's good and what's not, and what's helpful and what isn't. In some sense, and there's no way to fake an experience like what you were in. You can't put somebody in a simulator and shake it around and say, see, are you scared? Well, it's a simulator. You have to really be there. And so the more we're able to open our practice and be unprotected, this is really, again, the story about the four things the Buddha saw. That was the moment when he was willing to be unprotected. He was willing to throw off the protection his parents tried to give him, essentially grow up, be out there, and see what it was. See it, smell it, taste it, touch it, the indignity of it, the crappiness of it, the trivialness of it, the decaying corpse, the other side of life. And to embrace that and say, I'm going to be open to it. There's a great poem by Lew Welch that I love very deeply. It's a title poem of Ring of Bone. Do any of you know this poem? I saw myself, a ring of bone, in the clear stream of all of it. And I vowed to be open to all of it. And then I heard ring, where ring is what a bell does. This is the poem. I'll say it again. I'm especially interested in the part where he says, and I vowed to be open. I saw myself a ring of bone, essentially like an x-ray, a corpse. He saw who he really was. I saw myself a ring of bone in the clear stream of all of it. And I vowed to be open to all of it. This is our vow as Buddhists. I vow to be open to all of it, whatever happens. And then I heard ring. You know, that poet, ear, I heard ring, where ring is what a bell does. He turned the word ring from his skeleton, that sense of existential nausea, angst. Life is pointless, useless, ring of bone, you know, nothing but bones and flesh. And suddenly it sang to him, you know, ring, like that. Just beautiful. So you had one of these ring of bone experiences, and it, you know, like that. So if you hear it, then it becomes your teacher, and then that's the fifth and most, I think, most important kind of inquiry. The whole world shakes you up, and if you can survive it, I think anyone who practices the way assiduously has that experience. And there's a lot of stories in Zen about that, about somebody who thinks they have it. And they do in a certain sense, but except for the fact that they think they're kind of stuck, you know, the inquiry kind of gets stagnated. And then somebody has to shake them up big time, or something has to hit them. You know, I always joke about the turkeys the last two times I've come, and it's funny, but I think I'll tell you why I like the turkeys, because it's like that. You know, we think we're here, and suddenly, you know, there's something, I don't know, I like it a lot, that it, you never know when they're going to do it. And they don't care. And the world is like that. And there's, you know, when you open yourself to this world, you open yourself to the way things really happen. And it's what people used to call magic, because you can't really explain it. But things happen all the time that are a little like quantum or something. They come off from, and you get some flavor of it finally, and you're not so surprised when it gets you, when it hits you. It's like the turkey. So we have this slang word, a turkey is really bad. You know? I'm sorry for the turkeys, because turkeys aren't that bad, but we say this was a complete turkey. But a turkey could stand in for that kind of moment where you think you've got some place to stand and then the rug gets pulled out. As long as the rug can get pulled out, then you're vulnerable. One good definition for Buddhahood would be someone who is stable, who doesn't stand any place. In fact, it says, this is a phrase in the Buddha Sutras, that the Buddha does not stand anywhere.
Maybe in the back of my mind, well, no. But they're all gone now. I don't even think it makes that much difference. And I tell you, I really kind of wonder if they have that. I'm not a privileged person, but I'm not.
Well, ultimately, there's no reason. You're just fortunate. And I am too. I've been through some very serious things that people have written me off for dead more than once. But I'm still here. You're still here. I think, so, you know, it's human nature and it's the nature of the mind to want to know why. And one of the things that these kinds of experiences, it's kind of a fork in the road. Either we make up some reason that makes us special, go that way, or we go the other way and says, why is not necessarily the most important question. It's what. What am I going to do now? Everybody's a miracle, actually. And, you know, you're dead three times over without modern medicine. I'm dead twice over, at least, maybe three times. I'm sure, you know, this fellow's got prostate cancer. I mean, but why isn't as powerful a question as what? So here you are, here I am, what are you going to do? Let's set aside why, because there's a little bit of speculation in that. I think it's wonderful that you've gone through it. And oncologists, let's put it this way, I've had a lot of experience with them too. Most of their patients die. So they're very happy with folks like us. They really are. So here's the only useful reason I can think of is that your survival is the purpose of it is to make your oncologist happy. When I went, I was going through treatment, I had a year of treatment 15 years ago, and I would go to for radiation, same place you went, I think, we talked about this. And the residents, I first of all get examined three times by the resident, the senior resident, and then by the big doctor. They all do the same stuff. But the residents who hadn't seen us a lot were just so happy when I was alive. And I thought, I don't feel so great, son, you know. You shouldn't be so happy. I mean, I'm glad that you're happy as a doctor, but, you know, this has been very tough. I don't feel good. Oh, this is wonderful. All your prognosis is great. Look at that, you know. So this is why we go through it, so the doctors can be happy.
It was, yes, I was happy, my exhaustion and all, I could do everything, but that was a genuine piece of it, too, with somebody who had seen me, was so elated about my sin. I mean, it was just incredible, you know, to have somebody who respond that way to me. And it totally took me out of where I was. And I would leave, also, not so much about the treatment, but by their perception of you. I was like,
You know, when you can be happy for someone else, that redeems your life. I'm speaking again to your situation. That's one thing that we can do. We can be happy for other people. And that's such a gift. Then we're not so alone. So to be happy for ourselves is good, but to be happy for another person is better. We have time for one more thing.
Because my mother died of cancer. And the doctor's relationship wouldn't be love and wouldn't be comfort on that. So please get the balance between that two things. And I think that you shouldn't be too good too. And I know I've read a book that said, you know, the 9 times out of 10, the doctor says, hey, you've got 7 months, the person just kicks off, like, at, on time, you know, by the clock for what the doctor says. And we really need to open up our vision of what reality is and how much of people can face it.
It's very hard to do. Any doctors here? It's hard. You good? But it's hard to be a doctor. You have people's lives in your hands, and you know, you have feelings too, and you either can open to it or not, and so on. So. We have to have compassion for all sides. Well, they're starting to. That's really changing. I think the fact that more women are becoming doctors is forcing the medical schools to make some adjustment. I have a friend, we're running a little over, but I have a friend whose daughter is a surgeon. She's the chief resident now in her hospital, and she's an extremely heartfelt person. Most surgeons are a little this way, you know, but she's very, and so all the, there's a little bit of a problem because all the surgical patients want her to be their surgeon, and they, you know, they have to spread it around, and so she's very popular. I think that's changing, and I think that it's only been since maybe World War II, when we started to have the technologies, the doctors started to lose that basic sense that their fundamental purpose there was to be with you while you're sick, and began to feel like technicians. So the training has moved that way. But I think the pendulum is swinging back. And that's good, because I think as we're finding out, the technologies only go so far. And in the end, whether you're a doctor or not, the best and most important thing you can do for someone who's sick is to really be with them and acknowledge them. So anyway, we're running a little over. I know probably many of you have to leave. So let's wind up for today. I probably won't be back for a while, not until Sylvia needs to be away and wants me to come again. So. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you, your wonderful group. Have a good morning. Goodbye.